Hello and welcome to season 3 of Radio SGN. I am one of your humble hosts, A.V. Eichenbaum, pronouns they, them. We're coming out on Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Just a friendly reminder to all of our listeners out there that the prison industrial complex does indeed affect black and brown folks disproportionately compared to those of the mayonnaise-style complexion that our co-hosts have, and should be abolished. Also, a nice little reminder that MLK has been whitewashed throughout history, and that at one point he was too radical for the FBI. A riot is the voice of the unheard, and Lindsay Anderson is here with me. She, her pronouns. Lindsay, how are you?
Hello, I am good, and I just want to give a quick disclosure to all of our listeners that I am not alone in this room, my bedroom, which is the quietest room in my apartment, but I am joined by my cat, Oliver, and one of my dogs, Benji, so if you hear scurrying in the background, that would be what that noise is.
Always a pleasure to have our animal friends join. Of course, they will be featured heavily at SGN_books, especially, particularly, Oliver, cat king of the library. Lindsay, it's been a busy time for us here, even though we've been off air for a little bit. What have you been up to? How was your holiday?
My holiday was good. I was mostly just chilling, you know, catching up on some sleep and stuff, and also trying not to die in the ice apocalypse that hit Seattle right before Christmas. Like many of maybe our listeners or people that were seen in my TikTok feed for the next couple of days, I ventured into the street and fell and did not stop falling for 24 hours.
Got to get yourself some yak tracks. They are not a sponsor of the show. They are just practical. I, of course, missed that because I was visiting family back home in California, which is, of course, underwater as we're recording this because of climate change, basically. I can't remember what the actual... Atmospheric river. An atmospheric river is flooding my home, and my family is safe as far as I'm aware. So there's a lot of mudslides, a lot of Santa Cruz's flooded, because of the ocean and the river and God's wrath, if you believe in a God. I've also been very busy. Not only have I been writing for Seattle Pride Magazine with our partnership with the SGN, I have also had one of my horror stories published and read aloud on The Ugly Radio. You can listen to that if you go check out The Ugly Radio on all podcast platforms. And The Scarab Archives, which is another horror project that I do a voice of a non-binary teen for, Cal is their name, that had its long overdue season finale for season 3, and it looks like they're going to be asking me back for season 4, which is a lot of fun. In addition to that, just been busy in my personal life. My personal life's really taken off. It's been really strange having a weekend every once in a while. So, wild, wild times. Speaking of horror things, though, the Meganing has happened. We haven't watched the film yet. Lindsay's shaking her head. You can't see it.
Oh, sorry. I forget that you can only hear me. It is tragic that we haven't seen it yet, but I think that we owe our viewers, like, a live tweet as we watch it, you know? Some kind of, like, I want our live reactions to Megan.
We are finally back in the Twitter sphere. It did not collapse in 2022, as a lot of people thought it would. It's just become harder and more toxic. What doesn't kill you makes you stronger, apparently, and Elon Musk is a cockroach among men. The difference is I have respect for cockroaches. Also, speaking of horror, our guest coming up is J.T. Seaton, who is, of course, the founder of the Queer Screams Film Festival. It's a great chat, and we're going to have all that and more after these messages.
Seattle Public Theater proudly presents This Bitter Earth, the story of love challenged by political reality. Experience the life and reality of Jesse, a thoughtful black playwright, and his boyfriend Neil, a white Black Lives Matter activist, as they navigate their life together. As passions and priorities collide, this couple is forced to reckon with issues of race, class, and the bravery it takes to love out loud. Directed by Brandon Ivy, This Bitter Earth runs January 27th through February 19th at Seattle Public Theater. Tickets and information available at seattlepublictheater.org.
Ever dreamt of sharing your life story in a memoir? Thought about writing a novel with the queer characters you've always wanted to read? Professional editor Sheila Loesch specializes in working with first-time authors to take them from first draft to final copy. She's local, she's queer, and she's dedicated to telling your unique story the way you've always wanted to. visit SheilaLoesch.com. That's SheilaLoesch.com to get started on the book you've always wanted to write.
Will you marry me? It's the question you were waiting for. Now, let us help plan your perfect day. The Seattle Wedding Show comes to the Seattle Convention Center January 28th and 29th. Over 350 wedding experts to help you create your dream wedding. Find your photographer, florist, and caterer. Sample cakes and enjoy daily fashion shows. The Seattle Wedding Show, January 28th and 29th at the Seattle Convention Center. Use discount code SGN for 20% off tickets at weddingshow.com.
Gotta do the self-care.
How are you? Still a little low?
Well, therapy's been good, but it might be smart to lock up the oxy from your surgery.
Are you worried?
Well, I know not to take medication that's not mine, but I don't want to have it around on a hard day.
I'll lock it up.
That's very caring.
That's me, self-caring for everyone.
Protect the ones you love from opioid misuse. Lock up your medication.
Hi, this is Dr. Vigil with Vigil Family Medicine, and I would like to tell you a quick story about my primary care practice. I had a patient text me about a cat bite injury to her hand, and she was worried it was now infected. I saw her in clinic that day, cleaned the wound, and arranged for a tetanus shot and antibiotics, saving her critical time, an ER visit, and hundreds of dollars. If you want to know how direct primary care can benefit you, contact me at 253-693-0071 or at vigilmd.com.
Joining me today via Zoom is someone I'm very excited for you guys to meet. He is a co-founder of the NOLA Horror Film Fest. He's a director of photography. He's working for the Queer Screams Film Festival in Portland. Please welcome to the show JT Seaton out of Portland, Oregon. JT, hello.
Hello.
Welcome to Radio SGN. How are you?
I am fantastic. Thank you for having me on.
Well, thanks for being here. So I'm a big horror nut. We talked about this on the show, me and my co-host, for Christmas. I love Christmas horror movies. That's kind of my bag. But how did you get into horror?
That's a good question. I'm actually not quite sure. I was always into horror, even as a young lad. Growing up in Bakersfield, California, I was always into horror. My room was always decorated with horror movie posters. I had fake spider webs on my walls year round. I had a waterbed when I was younger. Remember those? Anybody remember those? Does anybody still have a waterbed? And I had a bunch of masks on the back headboard of my waterbed, horror masks and things like that. So I feel like I've always been into it. I want to say like the first couple of films that really made an impact on me when I watched them as a kid were the original Phantasm from 1979 and, of course, the original Halloween and Dawn of the Dead were some of the early films I remember seeing as a child and being really affected by those films.
I think mine was, I was staying over at someone's place and they just left the TV on and Freddy's Dead came on. The fifth or sixth movie in the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise is where I started.
Six.
I mean, I've seen all of them since then because I became obsessed with it. But there is something very cathartic about being a young queer person watching a bunch of straight teens get murdered by a dude in their sleep. You know, God, yeah. Those jocks. So let's talk a little bit about this film festival. So you've done the New Orleans Horror Film Fest.
Yes.
Which is, as of 2021, one of the world's 50 best genre festivals, according to Movie Maker Magazine, which is a big deal. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. Well, I started the NOLA Horror Film Fest with a filmmaker friend of mine back in 2010. And we had met in 2009 at a film festival in Florida. We met another filmmaker from Belfast, Ireland at that time. And the three of us became fast friends. And then in 2010, we went to Belfast because that filmmaker had a film festival. Mm-hmm. And the new filmmaker friend of mine, Blake, that I met in Florida, lived in Mobile, Alabama. So I took a trip to visit him in Mobile, Alabama. And he said, well, since you're coming, let's make a movie. So we did. And then we drove to New Orleans to shoot some exteriors and discovered at that time in 2010 that New Orleans did not have a horror film festival, which was completely odd to us, being one of the most haunted cities, you know, in the world.
Right. They even have like vampire festivals. They have the rich history of Southern Gothic and New Orleans Gothic specifically. You'd think that that would be something that they would be doing.
Yeah. But at the time, in 2010, it did not exist. So Blake and I decided, hey, we'll do that, rather foolishly. Because at the time, neither one of us had any knowledge or history with film festivals. We basically just chose a date. The film submission platform that was available at the time was Without a Box. It wasn't even, Film Freeway wasn't even around, which is what people are using now to submit mostly to film festivals, online film festival submission platform. So Without a Box, we signed up, we found a venue, and we just went for it. Foolishly, made lots of mistakes in our first couple of years. And finally, somewhere around year four, we kind of cut a groove. And it slowly started to build from that point on. And so 2020 was our 10th season. And unfortunately, we didn't get to have a good 10-year anniversary bash because of something called COVID.
Right.
That some people might have heard about. I don't know.
Yeah, one or two folks might remember that, you know, back in the day, way 2,000 lifetimes ago. So let's talk about the Queer Screams Film Festival. So is this the first year you're doing this? This is a new thing.
Yes. Yeah, this is a brand new thing. I had always been interested in, I'm going to backtrack just a tad.
Absolutely.
You had mentioned Movie Maker Magazine selecting NOLA Horror Film Fest as one of the top 50 genre film festivals in the world in 2021. One of the things that I really appreciated about the write-up and the article that they gave for us was that they mentioned that the film festival was specific in championing female filmmakers as well as LGBTQ filmmakers. And that was very important to me. And so once I moved up here to Portland and tried to figure out, okay, what am I going to do now? You know, I'm no longer going to be doing the NOLA Horror Film Fest. Should I just get involved with existing film festivals that are up here? And I am, actually. I help out a lot with the Portland Horror Film Festival as well as the H.P. Lovecraft Film Festival up here in Portland. And just kind of thought, well, you know, now is the time to take that good feedback from the NOLA being a champion of LGBTQ horror. Also, the timing was just, you know, right with the Queer for Fear documentary series that was on Shudder, you know, last year. And it just seemed like, you know, now is the time. People are interested and ready to support a film festival that is specific to queer genre experience.
There are a lot of queer and LGBTQ plus horror fans out there, you know, and there are a lot more openly queer horror movies now and a lot more openly queer independent filmmakers, just because it's a little bit more accepted, which is fantastic, because it used to be coded. It was queer coded. It wasn't out in the open. And that, while it's nice to see representation, it's better to see representation, honestly. Like, there was the movie that just came out, They/Them, which our film reviewer had a field day with. But they're, you know, there's a lot of mainstream queer movies coming out.
Well,
how
I mean,
do you feel about that, I guess, is the question.
Yeah.
Here.
Well, I'm excited for it. You know, like I was just going to say, M. Night Shyamalan's new film, The Cabin in the Woods, features a, you know, queer couple as the protagonist of the film. So I think that's very interesting. Yeah, it's great to finally see, you know, queer representation in a positive light. There is a book called Queer Screams, incidentally enough, written by Abigail Waldron, that came out last year, that was basically all about queer representation in genre films specifically, talking a lot about the Hays Code from the early 50s and 60s, where it was basically illegal to have a queer character and everything had to be coded. You couldn't do it. And also the queer character, if there was a queer character, had to be villainized and at the end of the movie be killed so that, you know, we can return to heteronormity at the end of the film. And that for years was our representation, being in a horror film, being the villain and being killed at the end. The thing that it's interesting, and you'd mentioned also that there's a lot of LGBTQ who identify or are horror fans. And that's one of the things that we identify in, is because horror often is about the other. Mm-hmm. Usually the monster is the other. Obviously Frankenstein's monster is, you know, an other, an outcast. And we can identify with being an outcast. We can identify specifically, like Frankenstein is a great example. You know, here is a creature that was created and is an outcast, and then eventually in the end is disowned by its creator. And same thing happens with so many LGBTQ kids who come out to their parents and are disowned by their parents. You know, so we can, as a queer audience, can identify with the other, can identify with, you know, the monster.
Yeah, absolutely. The genre films, I'm a huge fan of giallos. I'm a big fan of Dario Argento. Suspiria is great. I prefer Deep Red, personally. I think that's one of my favorites. But have you seen Knife Plus Heart?
Yes.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite movies of all time. And to see such an honest, queer representation, the personalities, the people, in such a dramatic and strange thriller was life-changing for me. And I'm sure that there have been other people out there that have had movies that have treated them the same way. But there is a love of camp and a love of genre and drama that the queer community has adapted and adopted and put into our own art and our, you know, drag queens and everything else. Dragula is a huge hit on Shudder as well.
Yeah.
There's a lot of crossover. Sorry, I'm going off topic. What do you have favorite movies? Do you have favorites? Is it hard to choose favorites?
I definitely have favorites, but I'm an old school favorite guy. I mean, my favorite films are from like the 70s and 80s. For me, the 70s is the greatest all-time decade of film in history, just film in general.
Sure.
Just the quality of film that came out in the 70s, and you know, the auteurs and the filmmakers who basically were given free rein to do whatever they wanted to do, and they did, which is amazing. So my favorite film of all time is The Shining. I think it is just a masterpiece of cinema, just in and of itself, beyond being a horror film. Mm-hmm. But I'm also a fan of, you know, Phantasm and Carrie and The Exorcist and, you know, The Omen and a lot of the films from the 70s and into the early 80s. You know, John Carpenter's The Thing. Pretty much all of John Carpenter's early work is within my canon. The Fog is one of my all-time favorite films. I watch it every April 21st because that's the birthday of Antonio Bay.
Good to know. We should add that to our calendar in case anyone wants to do that. We could all do an April 21st watch of The Fog and talk about it on the show at some point. I love little traditions, you know.
Another great little tradition is you would think you would watch it in October, but the best thing to watch on St. Patrick's Day, Halloween 3, Season of the Witch.
Interesting.
Silver Shamrock. You know, it's all about the Irish and their evil plot to kill all of the children of the world. What better movie to watch on St. Patrick's Day?
Leprechaun?
Leprechaun is a good movie to watch on St. Patrick's Day. Maybe a double feature.
Ooh, yeah. So let's jump back to the film festival. When is this happening? How can we find it online? How can we get involved?
Yeah, the festival itself is going to happen in August. It is going to be August 18th through the 20th. And it's going to be at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. And the Clinton Street Theater has a long history of supporting LGBTQ cinema. It's also one of the longest running live performance shows of Rocky Horror Picture Show in the country, for those who are unaware. Hmm. But that's where, you know, you go to see Rocky Horror here in Portland is at the Clinton Street Theater. So Clinton Street Theater is very supportive of LGBTQ. And they're very excited about the festival to be able to be involved. So the Friday night element of the festival is probably going to be a queer classic genre film. And then the Saturday of the festival is going to be all new work. It'll be new films by either, you know, emerging filmmakers or established filmmakers in the genre, but it will all be new work. It won't be, you know, classic horror films. And then on the Sunday, I'm hoping to bring in some special guests, you know, maybe the executive producer of Queer for Fear. I've been in talks with him about coming up, and get some special guests to come in on that Sunday to do a, you know, panel discussion and a Q&A and maybe a special screening of a film from that particular guest. So, yeah, so the idea is to incorporate both new works of queer horror cinema as well as celebrating existing or previous works.
And you're taking submissions as we're speaking. How long are you taking submissions for that?
We'll be accepting submissions through June 20th.
Wonderful.
It's going to be the end of the submission date. We accept short films, feature films. We don't do screenplays, but I know there's a lot of, there's a lot involved with doing a screenplay competition. And maybe that's something that we'll branch out into, because we did that with NOLA Horror Film Fest. We did have a screenplay competition, but this year, the first year, I wanted to kind of focus on film and just kind of have it be features and short films with LGBTQ characters. In order to qualify to be screened at the festival, the film has to either be made by an LGBTQ filmmaker or contain a main character that is LGBTQ. So as much as that is possible, those are the qualifiers for submissions.
Great. Well, we're running up on our time here. Thank you so much for being here. Where can we find you online, and where can we find the festival?
Yes, the festival has a website, queerscreams.com. Just very straightforward. I was very surprised that website domain was available.
Yeah.
So queerscreams.com is the film festival website. We also have a Facebook page and an Instagram page. You can follow us at Queer Screams on Instagram and Queer Screams on Facebook. And yeah, so definitely come out, you know, put us on your calendar for August to come on out and support new voices in queer horror cinema. And it's going to be a great time. And, you know, obviously, you know, people want to get involved. They can. We'll definitely be needing volunteers to help out with the event. And anybody who wants to help out in any other way, financially or elsewise, is totally great. You can reach out again through the website, queerscreams.com.
Fantastic. Well, JT, thank you so much for being on the show today. Really happy to have you.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Lindsay, what do you want to talk about today?
You know, I would love to talk about our lovely advice columnist, Isabel Mata's recent contribution to Ask Izzy. This is a topic that has played a role in my life. I'm sure it plays a role in your life as well. But Izzy was asked to explore different gender-neutral alternatives to the classic partner and significant other, because both just feel a little too formal, especially partner, which kind of feels like, I don't know, a cowboy or a lawyer, or I think of it as like it's been heterofied because every white cis liberal arts professor I had in college would like reference their husband as their partner, and I just thought there was a bunch of gay people around me. Turns out they were all white cis women trying to be progressive. So
let's read the question for Ask Izzy. Dear Izzy, I'm a non-binary person who recently started dating a non-binary person, and we're having trouble finding a gender-neutral name for our relationship. None of the words out there really feel right. It feels too soon for partner, but significant other feels sterile. I'm definitely not calling them my boyfriend. The language around non-binary folks really needs to evolve. What do I do? From Anxious NB. You know, Isabel came through. She has a whole list here that I'd like to read to you, and we can maybe discuss each term. She's split them into two categories. For a non-serious relationship, etc., she's got date, date friend, date mate, lover, paramour, sweetie, sweetheart, cuddle buddy, fae friend, person friend, NB friend, both friend, gender friend. And for a long-term, more serious relationship, she's got partner, person, S-O, significant other, other half, steady, soulmate, beloved, love bug, love person, epox, companion, and Ismadi, which is from Star Trek. Ismadi is what the Beta Zed call their soulmates, which any of you TNG fans know. Riker and Deanna Troi, Ismadi. I really love that one, but it is very, very dorky. And not everyone likes Star Trek as much as I do.
Well, and as somebody that does not partake in that community, I feel like it would be appropriation for me to use that phrase. But good for everybody who does.
Honestly, a lot of millennials out there would get pretty pissed, I feel. Because, you know, we really have to hunker down and, like, grab on to whatever our identity was as a teen to feel safe. Because, you know, nobody ever changes. I get to bash millennials this season.
I love it. I bash millennials every day, so.
I'm aware.
It's my personality trait.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's talk about this. So you're dating a non-binary person. I am a non-binary person. We both agree, partner feels...
It feels like businessy. Stuffy, yeah.
It feels stuff. I don't like gender friend either. It's a good suggestion, but it does feel kind of like, oh... I found someone who's the same gender as me, which is not how non-binary really works at all. Because there's a lot of gray area there. There's a lot of space. And depending on the day, I might not feel one way or the other. And I don't want to force that codependency and simpatico on another person, especially if I'm dating another non-binary person. That doesn't seem fair. Person? My person? That's very sweet.
I like that one, but I feel like it's very ambiguous as well. You know, like it could be, like me and my best friend would refer to each other as my person, like, you know, a callback to Grey's Anatomy. So I think there's like a lot of platonicness that could be assumed through that. And then especially if you're in a relationship that is femme presenting, that's an issue with a lot of people just automatically assuming platonic, you know, even if you're out holding hands or like experiencing PDA. So it's the, they were roommates, ification.
It is kind of funny to watch two femme presenting people make out and be like, wow, they are really good friends.
But they do. I mean, and it's because of, not to bring up my sister again on this podcast, but it's because of people like her that, you know, will be like, oh yeah, I kiss my girlfriends all the time, but it's super straight. We're just drunk.
Okay, so soulmate. That's a lot.
That is a lot. Did Izzy have this list as the long term or?
This is for long term. Okay. Yeah, soulmate is long term.
Well, that's good, I would assume. If you're calling your whoever, your soulmate on, you know, the third date, that's a red flag, listeners.
I mean, sometimes, you know, when you know, you know. But I kind of have been operating since I was like 9 years old under the assumption that there are no soulmates. And if they are, like, I believe in reincarnation, maybe my soulmate was dead 100 years ago.
And that's on being adult children of divorce.
My folks weren't even divorced yet.
Really?
I was just sad. I was just a sad kid.
Dang.
But, you know, I've been thinking a lot about it. You know, maybe soulmates do exist, or maybe there's a lot of soulmates for a lot of different people, or maybe we're all the same soul reincarnated over and over again, dreaming the same dream of existence, and there's no such thing as an objective reality. But love bug. What do we think about love bug?
Well, it immediately reminds me of Herbie Fully Loaded.
Yeah. The Herbie films do evoke that sort of non-binary-ness.
Well, yeah. Herbie definitely is a they-them icon.
He's a he-they, I think.
A he-they?
But sure. I think so. I think they call him a he.
How can you determine a car's gender? That's something that always bothers me.
Yes.
When people are gendering, like, inanimate objects. I mean, we've talked about this on the show because of the way that I've gendered my dog by putting Patricia in drag. But I think it's, like, a step further when people, you know, are like, my car is a woman in her 40s with blue-gray hair.
Sometimes people just need to feel like they have friends. And if you gotta personify your vehicle, maybe it's healthy.
You know what? If you need to feel like you have friends, do what I do.
Mm.
Go to the animal shelter, bring home a pregnant dog, and then you've got 10 friends.
That's healthy.
Right there.
That's healthy and agreed upon.
And they'll come back to visit you.
Absolutely.
Because I'm dog-sitting one of my former foster babies right now. They never
we
leave.
Got a lot of other things to talk about, but I do want to talk about Paramore, because this is one that has come up before, for me, personally. And I feel like Paramore...
It's very French.
Sure, it is French, but it sounds more illicit. It sounds like it's the other person, you know? And sometimes, you know, if you're in a poly thing, you use paramour. Everyone agrees about it. It's sort of like an unspoken joke sometimes. But sometimes you use paramour and you're a banker from the 40s who's seeing some young thang on the side. You know, usually femme or female. And it just, for me, it feels very... You know what I mean?
Well, before we leave the topic, too, I want to know, what do you use in your life?
I have used partner. Not to get too much into my personal life, but flame is one I've been thinking about using. Twin flames brought together by time and circumstance.
It feels very timeless. I like that. It's like all those old people names coming back, you know? Let's bring back old people slang. Gender neutral old people slang. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's better than person friend, which does feel Orwellian to me.
I think person friend is fun. My person friend does not like that phrase as much, so I don't actually use it that often. The phrases I use, usually partner, but again, it feels like really stuffy because I'm like, I'm 23, I'm too young to have a partner of any sort, you know. Sometimes I use the phrase boyfriend. I know the person in the Ask Izzy said that they won't be using that. I use it mostly to irritate and confuse my family members, but my partner also really likes it and it's pretty affirming for them.
That's
so
nice.
That works.
Yeah.
Yeah, and sometimes just sex partner. But again, that doesn't go over well at Thanksgiving, so...
No, and I can't imagine walking up to someone and introducing someone and being like, hello, this is my lover. You know what I mean? Like, I'm a tall, usually mask-presenting individual, and while I'm going to be trying to be wearing more makeup and presenting a little bit more femme in my 28th year, which is coming up... Christ, I often look like a bedraggled truck driver, and I'm not gonna put that on other people to figure out, you know? Oh, my lover. Ooh, it feels very slimy to me, but I'm just slimy, maybe. I like sweetheart also, but I'm kind of cheesy that way. I like sweetheart.
I don't like sweetheart because it's like something that a slimy old man would call, you know, and use to patronize. So it's like, it also depends on the experiences you have, I guess, what words work for you. But to me, sweetheart always feels patronizing, you know?
Well, when you're saying this is my sweetheart.
I guess, yeah. But I would like never want to be called
Not
that.
Like, hey, sweetheart, how about another drag of that cigarette? That's got the same vibe as lover. You know, not
it
a fan.
Does. Yeah.
Let's move on. Let's talk about something exciting for the community. Fatlesque Northwest. That happened. Celebrating body diversity. Kudos to them. Mixed Pucks Aplenty was a huge part of that. And they, of course, were our 2022 Performer of the Year for the SGN Reader's Choice Awards. Shout out to everybody who participated in that. You can go and check out the video, which somehow posted twice to our Facebook. I don't know what happened there. There were a lot of weird things, but you can go and check out Lindsay and me being doofuses and announcing these great performers and activists.
People, places, and things.
Yeah, just a wonderful thing. Fatlesque Fest Northwest, which is very fun to say, was a three-day cultural festival focused on celebrating body diversity in the world of burlesque performance, which, amazing, fantastic, you know? The fact that Seattle has such a diverse and thriving burlesque scene really says a lot to me about a city. Again, it feels very old-timey, but in a very positive way. What did you think about this?
I think it's super cool, and I'm totally behind. I sound like a politician. I'm totally behind body diversity. But, you know, in the same way that we've seen in the last, like, maybe 5 years, a new appreciation for and acceptance of LGBTQ people and identities, you know, at a level that, like, we've both talked about on this show, we did not experience growing up.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the body positivity movement is having the same kind of a moment. It's finally okay and celebrated to realize, like, not everybody looks the same and we don't all have to aspire to be Kim Kardashian or something, and that different bodies are beautiful.
It's really great to see here in the Pacific Northwest, which is such a cultural hub now and is becoming more of a hub as the years go on, coming from a place like California where beauty standards are Hollywoodized a little bit, you know? Mm-hmm. And I mean, I've never been on the other end of fat phobia because I was very, very thin. I was like crazy skinny for a long time because I had all these other issues going on with my own body acceptance. But I've seen it, and people I've dated have experienced it, and people that I love and care about have seen it, and it's really great to see people in a space that is supposed to be all about liberation and self-expression and the expression of body really taking charge of that in a way that it hasn't really been done before on this scale. It's really amazing. And Georgia did a great write-up, and everybody in this article has been super supportive of the article, so go and read it. Check it out, sgn.org, or pick up a copy today. They're still on shelves as we're recording, but they might get snatched up pretty soon because we got a lot of other news coming through.
Speaking of other news,
Arizona Republicans want to ban Sunday drag brunches and drag queen story hours. I'm pissed. I don't sound pissed.
Sometimes you're too tired to be angry, you know? And I feel like that's where we're at. As a culture, as a group of people, we work in the news. So we, write about this. We know these stories, you know, in and out more than maybe the average person. But it feels like it's just constantly, you know, they're coming after drag queens in Arizona. They're introducing anti-trans legislation in Oklahoma. You know, there's a new Congress in session, and we have a Speaker of the House that openly believes in QAnon theories about transgender people trying to turn you trans with milk.
Meanwhile, Tucker Carlson's getting mad about the Feminems. dude, just fuck an M&M. We're not gonna yucky yum here. We did a whole article on FurCon last week. Look, bro. Brother in Christ, Tucker Carlson, enemy of the show. You wanna fuck the M&Ms. We get it. We get it.
But would they wanna fuck him?
He called the purple M&M obese.
What? They're all round.
Yeah. Fat phobia in media, again, for no fucking reason. It's crazy to me because these conservatives who are all against drag queens continue to sexualize women in media to the point of nausea.
To quote a conservative idol, Ayn Rand, who I listened to a podcast about today.
Oh, God.
Ayn Rand believed that, you know, you can't have contradictions, that one is right and one is wrong, and you need to reassess your values. And the conservative ideology has this weird contradiction when it comes to gender. They're against expressing gender, right? They're against the hyperfeminine drag queens. They're against embracing your gender and your gender expression, gender identity. But then when you say, okay, well, then we're going to take gender out of it, and we're going to refer to everybody as mix. We're going to only use they, them pronouns for everyone. There will not be a boy section and a girl section in the Target children's aisle because that's absurd. Clothes don't have genders. Then they lose their shit all over again. And
I feel like maybe Tucker Carlson just needs to have his egg cracked. Their egg cracked. I don't know what they are on the inside. Used to wear bow ties. That's pretty queer. Let's talk about one more thing, because we've kind of gotten again off topic here, but we were talking about body positivity earlier, and kind of our episode has focused around that in a way. And Edmund's newest art facility, Graphite, announced a new exhibit opening January 21st, 2023. It's called Nude. N-U with a little accent, D, Nude, Art of the Figure. And I spoke with Tracy Felix, who's just a delight to talk to, about it. A lot of art has been sterilized and moved away from the naked human figure, the nude human figure, which does go back to thousands and thousands of years. And what Felix had to say was, when you think about naked people, a lot of people think it's sexual. But the figure in art goes all the way back to the Greeks and Romans, and possibly even before that, just a little side note. And she thinks that the lack of understanding and appreciation of the human body as an art form or as a subject in art is due to the lack of art education in our school system and the sexualization of the human body in mainstream media. And strangely enough, this does once again come back to sexualizing the female M&Ms and going against the human body in all shapes and sizes, in all diverse forms, with Fatlesque, you know? How do you feel about this? Do you get squeamish around nudes?
I do. I was raised Catholic, which we've talked about on this show a lot.
Right.
And I'm very prude when it comes to a lot of things that have to do with sex, even when, you know, there are things like the naked body that, you know, should maybe be desexualized because body parts, especially parts like boobs, you know, aren't sexual, and it's led to things like, you know, women not being able to breastfeed publicly, and I'm very squeamish when it comes to nudity. And I think it just comes from the way I was raised. There's a lot of shame in anything that can be associated with sexuality that you just internalize. And you internalize these lessons from such a young age that you don't even really realize it. But it's things like being raised as a female child, but not being able to run around with my shirt off like my friends that were born male were able to do. You pick up lessons on that even when, you know, at 4 and 5, my body from, you know, the top up didn't look any different than my male friends. You know, you're taught to have shame in your own body, and then you, in turn, you know, view other people's bodies with shame. And I think when we talk about, like, fat phobia, that's another aspect of it. A lot of times, the people that are fat phobic and, you know, display and say things that are fat phobic, it's because we're first taught to hate these things in ourselves, and then we project that hatred or that shame that we were told was undesirable in us as undesirable in other people. And that's where it becomes, you know, just a cycle of toxicity.
And that's the same for femininity and masculinity. Mm-hmm. All across the gender spectrum, people are taught to hate certain things and to feel a certain way instead of figuring it out for themselves. And I mean, I agree with Felix here. I think it has a lot to do with education. It's disheartening to see that in this day and age, we're trying to sterilize art. Like, I hate my body a lot of the time as a non-binary person. And I feel like a lot of people, male, female, non-binary, gender fluid, do hate their body.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I took mine back a little bit with, I'm covered in tattoos now. You know, I've been trying to wear my hair a different way. Again, I'm going to be wearing more makeup and nail polish and stuff. But do you ever feel like that?
Yeah, I do. And it's really interesting. I saw a TikTok, because everything comes back to TikTok with me, but I had this experience as a kid that I didn't think was very common. And then this other person basically detailed their life, and I was like, oh my God, that was me. I was such a tomboy as a kid that, you know, I think that my mom at least genuinely maybe had the thought in the back of her mind. I'm still surprised that she was surprised when I came out, except that maybe she was surprised that I like boys at all. But like, after I turned like 10, I would not wear regular girl swimsuit. I shopped in the boys section exclusively, boys board shorts and rash guards. And I would not wear feminine clothes at school. It was just like sweatpants, soccer jerseys, basketball shorts. And so I just had this really weird relationship with my body and my identity and my expression. But at the end of the day, like, I still feel more connected to myself as a girl than as anything else. But it's this idea that we gender clothing and body parts and things that maybe if we taught them in a gender neutral way, a lot of people would maybe have a different connection with their body if they didn't see it as, you know, exclusively tied to societal ideas about, you know, what is masculine and what is feminine.
Yeah, I had sort of the opposite experience where I wasn't really allowed to wear like form-fitting clothes at all. A lot of my clothes were way too big for me for a long time. I was 4'9 until the 9th grade. And a lot of my peers and a lot of other people around me were always like, you look like a girl, you have feminine hips, you have feminine lips. You know, so I started wearing a beard a lot. I had the ability to grow a beard in like the 9th grade, which again, I got a lot taller then as well. So I just kind of had this scraggly beard on my face. It didn't look very good. I try to keep better care of it now when I do have it. But as soon as I came out as non-binary, people were like, oh no, you're definitely a guy. You're definitely a man. You're a man. You're a he. You're a him. You know, and it's like, okay, but like my whole life, people were like, oh, you'd make such a great girl. I don't like the way that they said it most of the time, but as soon as I tried to like feel that way in my own personhood, in my own body, it was fought against. And it goes back to those contradictions and those sort of conservative values that even a lot of the most progressive or people who think they're progressive Americans come to hold.
I think that you described something that I can also relate to, that a lot of queer people can relate to, which is trying to perform your gender and what people expect of you, you know, when you become kind of self-aware. So like I was saying, like I was, you know, tomboy and dressed kind of like a little boy. That ended when I hit middle school because, you know, you become aware of how people are perceiving you and you get called a lesbian on the bus and, you know, you run home in tears if you're me. If you're you, it's a compliment. I definitely femmed it up for high school. I had rules for myself. Like, I wouldn't wear a flannel unless I had a full face of makeup and had done my hair, because flannels are gay, obviously.
True.
But it's these things that I hear all the time from people in the queer community about, like, embracing maybe something that doesn't feel natural to you innately, and then you find things in it that you like too, and so now it's like being an adult and trying to find that balance of, you know, what do I like that's feminine, what do I like that's masculine, and how can I make it my own without, you know, dressing or scrutinizing my body in a way that, you know, is because of how other people see me.
Yeah, I wore button-up shirts and ties a lot of the time in high school. And because I had a beard, people thought I was maybe a student teacher who just looked kind of young. Also, I was in, you know, student government, so I was in and out of the office all the time. People should have probably seen it, because all of my ties were like paisley, light blue, and like very floral, and all these floral prints, and I would like paint my nails on occasion.
The fact that you called your tie paisley, there's nothing straight about that.
I mean, that's the pattern. I love paisley. I love floral print. And there was a moment in like the late 2010s where floral print was considered very like masculine for certain outfits, and I was like, fuck yes. Yes, this is it. And then people were like, gay. And I was like, okay, taking the hat off, because it's a flat cap.
I do remember that. Oh, yeah. The flat caps. No.
You know, take the salt with the sugar, I guess. Well, folks, it has been a pleasure being back in the studio, being back. Radio SGN is a weekly show now, so you're going to be hearing a lot more from us this season. We're going to have a lot more guests. We've got Nate Gowdy as our guest next week. And Lindsay, you did write something about him in this week's edition. We'll definitely come back to that next week. Lindsay, anything you'd like to plug aside from our social media?
Oh yeah, please follow us on social media, TikTok, Instagram. I don't really have much going on at the moment. I'm just trying to get my puppy to not hump my cat. So that is what's going on in my life.
Wow.
Shout out to Urban Animal, because soon my boy will be neutered, and hopefully more chill.
Yeah, at radio.sgn on Instagram. We're going to be trying to get more active online for Seattle Gay News. Thank you so much to everybody who's been tuning in from the massive jump in followers we just got at Seattle Gay News on Instagram. We also still have a pretty strong following on Facebook, and Twitter does still exist, so that's crazy. Folks, again, thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next week. You won't see us because we're in your earbuds.
But we see you.
We definitely look at you.
I'm looking at you right now. I know exactly what you're doing. You're sitting on the toilet. Spooky, huh?
Why are you, like, my guy's on the bus.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
I
crazy.
I see someone else going for a run. I'm omnipresent.
And I'm omnisexual. Hey, guys. Thanks for listening. Tune in next week, and we'll see you in the funny pages.
Radio SGN is hosted by A.V. Eichenbaum and Lindsay Anderson, and produced by A.V. Eichenbaum. Music for this show was provided by T.R.G. Banks and Jesse Spillane, or was provided for free by Anchor. Thank you so much for listening. Check us out on sgn.org or wherever you find podcasts.